Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the presidential campaign season of 2008, the year that Americans would vote the first black man into the highest office in the land, journalist Will Haygood decided to look for an African-American whose work in the White House spanned the era of segregation, whose work in the White House spanned the eras that have mattered most to us living today. Someone who saw history from the inside out. Eventually, he hit the journalistic gold mine. Eugene Allen, a retired White House butler whose career has spanned eight presidents. Eugene Allen accumulated plenty of memorabilia during that time, but the story of a black man working at the elbows of the most powerful men in the world was what Haygood was shooting for. His article about Mr. Allen appeared in the Washington Post a few days after that historic election, quickly caught the attention of Hollywood and inspired a major motion picture starring Forrest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey. Columbus native Will Haygood is with us in the studio today to talk about the story that launched a nationwide discussion, really. He still writes for the Washington Post. He's the author of several books, the most recent of which is The Butler, A Witness to History. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Thank you.
You were covering the campaign in New Orleans in June when it occurred to you that Barack Obama just might win, despite predictions to the contrary from your family back home in Ohio. What convinced you that America was ready that night?
Well, first of all, I was actually in North Carolina.
I'm sorry.
There was a big rally. And after the rally, I walked outside. It was after midnight, and there were several young ladies, and they were crying. And I walked over to them and asked them if there was anything I could do. And they said that they were crying because their fathers did not want them to support this African-American candidate, and that they were not going to give in to their father's wishes. I thought it was a very powerful moment because they were judging Barack Obama by the content of his character, not the color of his skin, just what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wanted everybody to do. Right then and there, even with Obama down by 10 or so points and with Hillary Clinton still in the race, I said to myself, Obama's going to win this thing. I just felt it. Something in my gut told me that he was going to win because it felt like a movement almost. And I said, goodness, if this is translated from county to county, farm to farm, town to town, this is going to be unstoppable. And when I got back to my hotel room that night in North Carolina, I said to myself, not only is he going to win, but I want to be ready with a different story. I want to go out and search this country wherever I have to go and look and find somebody who worked in the White House before the big civil rights legislation, the bills were passed in the mid-60s, because I know such a moment, such a victory would have seemed improbable to this person, be it a White House painter, a White House maid, a White House butler, but I found the butler.
Right. There were lots of stories about how older African-Americans viewed the election, people who were mature by the time the 60s rolled along with the civil rights movement and the violence in the cities and so forth. How did you think to go to the heart of it all, though? There were, to the absolute heart.
Well, it just seemed to me that that's where the biggest emotion would flow from somebody, man or woman, if they had worked right there in the seat of power, if they heard the ripples, the echoes of the murder of Emmett Till, the murder of Medgar Evers, the integration of Ole Miss, the integration of all the Southern schools. All of those news events, of course, landed in the White House because the White House is a political engine of our country. It's the moral, it's the place where the moral utterances of the president are shared with the world. And so I figured if I could find somebody there, not in North Carolina, not in Mississippi, not in Alabama, because there's been a lot of those stories through the years, but it seemed to me it would be a unique idea. It was a very daunting challenge, but because whoever this person was, really I was looking for a ghost,
mm-hmm.
but whoever this person was, I just figured that they would have some amazing stories to tell. And just the simple fact that they were there is pretty amazing. Wouldn't be pretty amazing if I could find such a person.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Will Haygood, Washington Post reporter and author of The Butler, A Witness to History. Will wrote an article after the election in 2008 about this butler in the White House that started, I said, a national conversation. You received letters from all over the country, around the world. People loved this insider look. Did you feel like you revealed secrets about what was going on in the White House, or was it more just about kind of breathing the air of someone who breathed the air and having that feeling?
Yes, some of that certainly crossed my mind. Some of this crossed my mind. Mr. Allen was born in Virginia, in the seat of the Confederacy in 1919. So when he was a kid, if he met somebody who was African-American 70, 75, 80, they very likely were born a slave. So there's no doubt in my mind that he shook the hands of people who were born into slavery. And to talk about the arc, just the fact that he was alive to see the nation elect its first African-American president, it's something that some days I'll wake up and it's still quite astonishing to me that I found him.
I said gold mine.
Yes.
It's so amazing. You worked hard. It took a long time.
It took a long time. It did. I think I hate to use, you know, simplistic term like Forrest Gump or maybe Zelig, but he was in the White House when President Kennedy made his epic civil rights speech, although it was President Johnson who ultimately got the 1964 Civil Rights Bill passed in the night, much of the 60s, or at least the first half of the 60s. Worked and sometimes lived. When the weather was bad, he would spend the night at the White House. So he could leave the most powerful address in the world and go back to his native Virginia and have to use a segregated bathroom. What that might have done to him mentally is truly mind-boggling to me.
Goldmined as well, because he was very welcoming. He could have been a grouch and said, leave me alone, I don't want to talk about it.
Yes.
But he was the exact opposite.
Yes, he was. I think his wife, Helene, had a lot to do with that. I think, you know, both were getting on in years, very elderly. And I think she had a moment when she told herself, it's time for my husband to tell his story, because he was pretty surprised that I had found him. He wanted to know why I wanted to come over and talk to him. And I told him, I said, well, I just heard that you worked for three presidents at the White House. And he said, well, let me correct you. It was actually eight, Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan. You count them. And of course, I about fell out of my chair. And was very eager to go and sit with them. I mean, America, blacks especially, when they look at the White House photographs in the 50s, they see all white men, all white people. Ike and his cabinet was all white. But there was a black man on Air Force moments in his life. But this happened in the early 70s. He went to Sweden on Air Force One with the president. And he was in a shop. And a lady asked him, He had a $100 bill, and a lady asked him if he could keep an eye on his shop while she went down the street to get change for that $100 bill. And he said to me, he said, that would have never happened in America in a shop. Nobody would have ever trusted me and told me to keep an eye on their shop while they went out of my eyesight to get change for this $100 bill. And he was very emotional about things like that. And yet, he loved his country sometimes before the Civil Rights Movement more than his country loved him.
And his discretion was one way he showed it.
Yes, it was sly in what he would tell her, because butler. That term in the black community means more plantation. It's a word that connotes so many negative things. A butler, serve me, come here. Pain associated with that word in a way. I think that's one of the amazing things that Lee Daniels, the filmmaker, has done with the movie. But when you are a butler at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue at the White House, well, then that raises you to a pretty exalted level.
My guest is Will Haygood, Washington Post reporter and author of The Butler, A Witness to History. There's a movie now. It stars Oprah Winfrey and
Forrest Whitaker, Jane Fonda.
I mean, it's a cavalcade.
John Cusack
of stars.
Plays Nixon.
Right.
Yes.
I want to talk to you about how they attracted all these incredible artists to perform in a film that struggled to get funding in the first place. When we return, if you have a question or comment for Will Haygood, you're welcome to join the conversation. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there as well. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about a story that Will Haygood wrote back in 2008, or was published in 2008, right after the historic election that made Barack Obama our first black president. A book, well, a movie was inspired by the article. It's called The Butler. And Will Haygood has written a book to go along with that. It's called The Butler, A Witness to History. Will's with me in the studio right now. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a cut from the film right now. It explores the civil rights movement through the eyes of two different generations, a father and son. In this scene from the film, Cecil Gaines, played by Forrest Whitaker, sits with his family around the dinner table.
In the heat of the night with Sidney Poitier.
Sidney Poitier is a white man's fantasy of what he wants us to be.
What are you talking about? He just won the Academy Award. He's breaking down barriers for all of us.
By being white. By acting white. Sidney Poitier is nothing but a rich Uncle Tom.
Look at you. All puffed up. Put your hat on your head. Coming in here, saying whatever you want. You need to go.
What?
Get the hell out of my house!
What are you doing?
No, get on out!
Now everybody just sit
down. Sorry, Mr. Butler. I didn't mean to make fun of your hero.
Everything you are and everything you have is because of that butler.
Wow.
Yeah, very powerful. Every time I see that scene, I genuinely choke up. Wow, very, very powerful.
That was not the relationship that Eugene Alan had with his son. This was a dramatization.
Yes, yes.
Yes, for the movie.
Yes, yes. Some of the movie is...
It had a lot to do. This movie had a lot of work to do.
Yes, you know, because it really covers the entire sweep of the modern civil rights movement. In my original story, I had written that Eugene Allen lived during the time of marches and protests and assassinations and the sweep of the civil rights movement. And Lee Daniels, he simply told me, he said, I'm going to take that literally, Will, and I'm going to try to find a way into the story and film all of that. And so, yes, it is a big chunk for a filmmaker to take on. It took a brave filmmaker, and Lee Daniels is certainly that.
There was, Eugene Allen did have a conflict, a personal conflict at one point during the Johnson administration. His son, only child, was fighting in Vietnam. He was over there.
Yes. And that's amazing to me that the butler had to walk down the hall with the Pepto-Bismol or the bowl of oatmeal or whatever for President Johnson, the very man who sent his only child into the dark jungles of Vietnam. So you know that Mrs. Allen asked her son, asked her husband that night, hey, is there anything you can say to the president to get my baby home?
Can we pull some strings here?
Yeah, I only got one boy. And so Charles Allen, the son, did tell me, he said that he wrote a letter to his dad and said, Dad, it's raining over here. It's very dangerous. Is there anything you can do to get me out of the jungle? And his father wrote him a letter back and said, I knew President Kennedy a little better than President Johnson. And if President Kennedy was still in office, I'm sure I could do something. But as it looks now, you'll have to stay over there. Hang in there. Love, Dad. Oh, and that.
Because it was about relationships, ultimately.
Yeah. That's a movie in of itself right there. The butler, Vietnam, the butler's son, and the president who sent the butler's only son to defend his country. Really, both of them, butler and son, working for America in their own way, both of them. One with a gun, one with a tray.
Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome, Beth.
Hi. Hold on a second. I want to turn my radio down. I have a question. How does one become or get approached to be a butler for the White House? And how did first of all, I wanted to let Mr. Haygood know that my mother loved the article and couldn't stop talking about the article. So want to let you know that. And second of all, how did he get approached to become a butler? I mean, I know that in the past, cooks are picked by presidents who have a relationship with them and bring them to the White House. But what is the protocol for getting to be picked as a butler? And I'll just listen off. I'll listen while you answer the question on the radio.
Thank you, Beth.
Okay. Mostly word of mouth. Mr. Allen worked in a high-end country club in Washington, D.C. Somebody, saw him in action there. Whoever this person was, they had some stature in Washington. Obviously, they were a member of this country club. And they knew some people at the White House. And they said, hey, if you're looking for somebody, there's a guy, a young man, seems very courteous, very nice, very capable, working downtown at this country club, and you might want to take a look at him. And so he never went out looking for a job at the White House. He was recommended. And when the folks at the White House met him in 1952, he was hired. He was as surprised as anybody.
Were all of the service people black?
Yes. I mean, not all, but in overwhelmingly number of them were black, and overwhelmingly number of them were from the Deep South.
A favorite part of the book for me, which, by the way, the book, The Butler, A Witness to History, just reached the New York Times bestseller list. A favorite part of the book for me was when you reviewed your own life as a journalist and all the amazing people you had interviewed who informed you for this assignment. Kind of this collage of people that came to mind for you. Orville Faubus.
Yes.
If I pronounce his last name correctly,
yep.
I hope.
Yes, you did.
Go through that list of Orville Faubus, E. Frederick Morrow, Lewis Martin, George Wallace, James Meredith.
Yes, many of these people I met on assignment when I was at the Boston Globe and also at the Washington Post. These were story assignments in the South. I was covering Orville Faubus's last bizarre campaign to become the governor.
He was a former governor.
Yeah, former governor of Arkansas, and the governor who did not adequately safeguard the children who were attempting to integrate Little Rock Central High School because of the great and titanic 1954 federal U.S. Supreme Court ruling. David Duke, many years with the KKK, he was running for office in Louisiana, and I went down there, and I was at a rally, and I wanted to talk to him, and he asked me if I wanted to drive with him from one city to the next, and it was just me and him in the car, and I was driving, and he was sitting in the passenger seat, and I asked him about his thoughts about race, about black people, and it was simply unforgettable. James Meredith, who integrated Ole Miss by court order, lives in Mississippi, and I went down on the 40th anniversary of the integration battle at Ole Miss and spent time with him over the course of 3 days and wrote a very long story about him. And so all those stories gave me a deep knowledge, I think, in an understanding of the very complicated American South.
And the life that Eugene Allen
lived.
Lived.
Yeah,
from lived. Going from there to the White House.
Yes, yes. He undoubtedly also, I've written three major biographies, Adam Clayton Powell, Sugar Ray Robinson, and Sammy Davis Jr., and there's no doubt in my mind that Eugene Allen served Adam Clayton Powell because he was a congressman for more than 20 years, and he served Sammy Davis Jr. Because there's a picture of Sammy Davis Jr. and Mr. Allen in Mr. Allen's basement. And so the story, in a way, is almost somewhat biblical, not to go too far out on a limb, but in the Bible, it says, the last shall be first. And Mr. Allen, the man who used to serve the popcorn at the White House Theater, he's up in heaven now, and he's telling other people, hey, why don't you come to a movie tonight? And the movie's not about Ike. It's not about Truman. It's not about Kennedy. It's not about Carter or Ford or Nixon or LBJ. It's about the man who used to serve the popcorn in the White House Theater, Eugene Allen. So bless his heart.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Will Haygood, author of The Butler, A Witness to History, an article that Will wrote for The Washington Post back in 2008, inspired thousands of people across the country. It was about the butler, Eugene Allen, and it has now inspired a movie. It's a new movie. It's called The Butler, with an amazing array or an amazing cast. We have an email from Shelby. She says, this movie has a serious list of acclaimed actors and actresses. My question to Will is, how much input did you have in the selection of the cast? By the way, you're an associate producer. Wow.
Yes, yes. I was very proud of that.
Let's talk about the cast, because it is amazing. Forrest Whitaker, Oprah Winfrey star in it.
Yes. I was sitting around with the screenwriter, Danny Strong, who's a phenomenal talent, has won an Emmy, many other awards, and has written a hell of a movie, very textured, very nuanced, and very, very wide in scope. And Danny and I, we were talking about, man, who would be the ideal butler? And at the same time, we both see it, Forrest Whitaker. And
why Forrest Whitaker?
Well, he has that every man quality about him. I mean, he can disappear into a role. Movie stars, you always look at them and you see the star in the movie. But a actor like Spencer Tracy or Gene Hackman, they disappear into their roles. And you don't think Spencer Tracy or Gene Hackman, you think the role they're playing. And I think Forrest Whitaker is in that same category. Now, when I got a call from Pam Williams, the producer, and my goodness, she's a legend in her own right. But when she called me and said that, okay, we found the butler's wife, and who's really going to play the wife? And she said, I need you to sit down so I can repeat myself. And she says, I'm not kidding. The butler's wife will be played by Oprah Winfrey. And I went for a long walk in Washington, D.C., just thinking about that tandem, Forrest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey, one of my greatest, wonderful moments of many on the movie set. We filmed down in New Orleans, and I was there, was one day... the driver was driving me to the set, and he got a call that Oprah Winfrey was looking for me. And Evan is his name, and he said, well, Will's with me. He's here, and we'll be there in about 10 minutes. And Oprah's assistant said, well, hurry up, Evan, because Oprah wants to see Will. And Evan sped through a light, and I said, Evan. The light was red. Slow down. We'll be all right. But we finally got there safely, and we were filming a scene in the house. And they were both at this point of filming. They were elderly. It was to echo the day that I first met them.
Mm-hmm. When they were in their late 80s.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I go in, and I see Oprah, and she's dressed as the elderly woman that the Helene character is based on, and she starts talking like Mrs. Allen was talking to me. She said, yeah, we're gonna do everything we can to get that boy in the White House. That Barack Obama, he done got everybody so worked up. It'd be beautiful if he win, and me and Gene might get an invitation back over there, because it'd be lovely to see him up close and in person. It'd just be beautiful. And she said, she grabbed my hand, and I could tell she wanted me to rehearse with her. So one time failed actor that I was, I immediately picked up on that. And I got into character, and I said, oh, yes, Dad, we're going to do everything we can to get that boy in the White House. Everybody got to get out to vote. And she said, oh, yeah, it's going to be beautiful. And they're going to come back and get dinner going. Oh, and it was just a precious moment in my life. She stayed in character, and it was pretty special.
Helene did not live to vote for Barack Obama.
That was really
an amazing part of the story. Mm-hmm.
I interviewed them on a Friday, which 4 days before the election. That Sunday, their son, Charles, came over. She met him at the door, and she said, "Charles, I'm so happy. I'm so happy." He said, "Mama, what happened? Have you hit the lottery or something?" She said, no, nothing like that." She said, "There's a writer, a gentleman by the name of Will Haygood. He's going to do a story about my Eugene, your father. And I'm so happy because I just thought the world was never going to pay attention to him." And there were a couple other guests in the house, and she looked around. She said, "Hey, everybody, I'm tired. I'm going upstairs. I'm so at peace. Anyway, I'm going to bed. I'll see everybody later." She went upstairs and went to bed and died 1 day before the election of the nation's first African-American president.
And Eugene?
He went to the polls alone. It took willpower. I called him Monday because I had set up a photo assignment that very day, Sunday, the day before. I just called him just to check to see how the photo assignment went. And he said, I said, "Hey, Mr. Allen, how you doing? It's Will Haygood." He said, "She's gone." And I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "My wife, she's gone." I said, "Ah, she's gone where, to the store or something?" He said, "No, she didn't wake up. She died in the night." And I dropped the phone. I mean, I was just stunned. I was shell-shocked. I literally told the editor, I don't have a story, because it just felt like the bottom had dropped out of my story. And then there was some guilt. I wondered if I had
excited her.
Yes, yeah. You know, asked too many questions, if I had stressed her out or something, you know. And so it's very painful and hurtful. But that's when her son told me that story. He said, "No, Will, my mom was waiting on you. She was waiting on your knock at the door."
My guest is Will Haygood, author of The Butler, A Witness to History. His article in The Washington Post back in 2008 inspired a movie as well. We'll be coming to the theaters very soon. Will's book is on the New York Times bestseller list now, so if you want to check that out. We'll be returned with a little one more cut from the movie and more conversation with Will Haygood in a minute. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Will Haygood, the author of The Butler, A Witness to History. It's a book about the movie that was inspired by an article Will Haygood wrote in 2008 about the butler that served 8 administrations in the White House. Will be talking about the book with the editor that he worked with, and also the editor of the book The Butler, A Witness to History, at a free event on September 12th at 7 p.m. at Ohio Dominican University. We'll do our best to get a link up on our website at WOSU.org/allsides so you can learn more about that. But it's a free event, September 12th at 7 p.m. Will Haygood will return to town to talk about the book. So you can learn a lot more about it if you want to check it out that way. You know, let's go on and continue talking about the movie, because it's part of The Butler, A Witness to History. It's about the movie industry, too. Mm-hmm. You write about the movie industry, the making of the movie, the struggles to get it made, and how those struggles echo decade after decade of neglect of the issues that not only affected African-Americans in this country, but the whole country. I grew up in the 60s. I'd love to learn more about those riots that were going on when I was a fifth grader, kind of a thing. And there's a bleary past out there. We know they were civil, you know, there were riots. We know the civil rights movement, but it's never been documented in a dramatic form. Their stories have not been told. And this is in by virtue of this movie, at least a little bit of that story is being told.
Yes. Actually, I think it's a huge swath of the civil rights movement. It, Little Rock is in the movie, Selma, Alabama.
Right.
Dr. King's assassination. I mean, literally, there's never been anything on the American screen like this. It really does show the scope of the American civil rights movement. When I lived here in Columbus, on the east side in a housing project, when I was 13 years old, that summer there was a riot started on the OSU campus and then roved its way east. And then there was a riot on Mount Vernon Avenue, a very celebrated riot that I've written about in an earlier book. And there were so many social programs that grew out of the riots. I think a lot of kids, maybe the youth, think that we elected this black president because of goodwill from the past. But no, this has been a long struggle. There are a lot of people buried in the ground in this country who risked their lives to vote and for freedom and for dignity. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to come back and go to the out to the college.
Ohio Dominican
mm-hmm. University on Sunbury Road, because I was accepted into a program that grew out of the civil rights revolution. It was a program called Upward Bound, the Upward Bound program, which reaches into inner cities and gets gifted young kids who might not have or who might not be surrounded by the environment that would encourage you to go to college or might help you with your study skills and your study habits. And the Upward Bound program that I was in was at Ohio Dominican. And so this is my way to tell them how much I continue to be fond of those three summers that I lived on that campus as an Upward Bound student. And all that grew out of the civil rights. So
it's all connected.
It's all connected.
And the movie industry, they had a lot of a hard time getting funding for it. In fact, you wrote about how at a certain point in the filming in New Orleans, they basically knew they were going to run out of money.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, movies are always hard to, you know, hard to
right.
make. They're so expensive and everything, and it's so risky, you know. And to try to get a serious adult drama made is even more of a higher hill to climb. But we did it. There were major people, investors who came in. Sheila Johnson, former co-founder of BET, she was there in a huge way. Laura Ziskin, who first optioned my story. She was determined to raise money, and a lot of people came together to help make this movie. And then the Weinstein Company came in at the end, and you know, they know how to get movies out to the public. And the movie became a movement in itself. And now that it's getting all this wonderful press, it has also pre-sold to 32 foreign markets, and that's still climbing. So the movie is going to open in Denmark and Sweden and Germany and Italy, Mexico, all over the world. And that's really amazing. This humble butler and a big American story.
I thought Harvey Weinstein, who acquired the movie for distribution, as
yep.
you said something to you, and you wrote about it, that really caught my eye in the book. He said that what struck him most about the story was its perspective, that of the butler, a man who was a fly on the wall for decades in the world's most powerful home. And, you know, we in the journalism business, we're always talking about being the fly on the wall, but
yeah.
we never are.
No.
Ever.
Which is why we say it. Right.
It's a fantasy.
It's a fantasy. It's, you know, it's a dream. It's like, man, if you could have been at
the
White House,
the
last night. Dr. Martin Luther King was in there, and he gave Eisenhower a piece of his mind because, you know, because them kids in Little Rock were sped on, and people threw rocks. Oh, man, I wish I would have been a fly on the wall there. I mean, yep. Eugene Allen was. He was.
A lot of the actors in The Butler are very famous. We've already talked about Forrest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey, of course. Tell us about some of the others. They worked for scale.
Yes, they did. Everybody.
I mean, Jane Fonda.
Jane Fonda plays Nancy Reagan. Lenny Kravitz, he plays one of the butlers. He had a European tour that he was supposed to do. He would have made a lot of money, probably 100 times more money than he made on this movie, maybe 200 more times. But he thought the movie was important enough that he didn't do that tour. He came to Louisiana to film his role. There are six genres, mm-hmm. you know, with the costume, makeup, people.
Yeah, the costumes and the sets. And we're talking about eight generations of White House leaders. I mean, of American presidents.
Yes. Ruth Carter, who did the costumes, she did the costumes and was Oscar nominated for Amistad and for Spike Lee's Malcolm X. And I know who she is. And so when I met her, and I like fashion and movie fashion, especially vintage movie fashion. When I met her, that was pretty cool. That was very special to me. I walked up to her and said, "The Ruth Carter." And she said, "Yes." And she said, "Yes, and you are." And I said, "Well, my name is Will Hager." She said, "Oh, I know who you are. You're the person who wrote the story. You're why we all are here." And we hugged. It was instant friendship. It was just great. I mean, it was just great. One of the things, you know, watching Alan Rickman and Nancy Reagan.
Rickman as Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, and Alan Rickman. Yeah, one of the great things about watching them was the moment from The Butler's real life when First Lady Nancy Reagan told him that he would not be needed at a state dinner, which is a big event, you know, once a year, maybe twice a year. Sometimes there are state dinners. All the diplomats and CEOs are invited. It's a special ticket. And he was invited to be a guest at a state dinner, which was amazing.
We have a cut from the movie about that. After decades of service at the White House, Eugene Allen was surprised by the invitation from the First Lady. Here's that scene that is depicted in the film with Nancy Reagan being played by Jane Fonda.
Everyone says you're the man that got them raises and promotions. I had no idea.
I wish I could take credit for that.
I'd like to invite you to the state dinner next week.
I'm gonna be there, Miss Reagan.
No, not as a butler, Cecil. I'm inviting you as a guest.
But the president prefers for me to serve in person.
Don't you worry about Ronnie. I'll take care of that. So we'll see you next week, you and your wife.
That was a big deal to them. That was the only photograph that they had upstairs, public,
right,
of their time in the White House. Of
his time.
I went
to visit, yes. And I was sitting there, and I knew nothing about the state dinner. And I said to myself, gee, it's kind of odd.
Nancy Reagan.
Just one photograph, and it's the Reagans? What's up with that? That was my thinking. And, of course, later I knew why that moment and that photograph was so important to them. Just think, he's the butler. She's the butler's wife. It's like a Cinderella moment. They're both. They're with the high and mighty. I mean,
Helmut Kohl was the guest of honor.
Yep, West German chancellor. And they've been lifted up into that rarefied air. Their names were right in the New York Times list, the invited guests to the state dinners. That's a tradition. And their names were. I went back when I was doing research to look at that because I just wanted to see their name in the paper, and it said Mr. and Mrs. Eugene Allen. I mean, this is the man who used to stock the champagne at the White House. Now he's being served the champagne because of his illustrious service to the White House. 34 years, never missed a day of work. When it snowed or when there were the riots that hit Washington, he walked to work because he figured that the first family needed him. That's amazing.
There's a true story, and I don't know if it's going to be depicted in the film or not, but what he did with the Kennedy children a few days after the assassination, it was very touching. It was probably one of the, more touching parts of the story to me.
Yeah.
Was the initiative he took.
Yes, yes. He felt the sadness around the White House after the assassination in Dallas, and he wanted to do something to bring smiles to the faces. And he was a quick thinker on his feet, and he came up with an idea. He said, I'm going to have a birthday party. So he went to the chef and said, hey, whip up some cakes and get some ice cream going. And he said, because there's going to be a birthday party. He told his staff, hey, if you got kids, hustle home and bring them back here to the White House this afternoon because we're going to have a party. And it was the first time in a day and a half, 2 days, that laughter had returned inside the White House.
Yeah, pretty special guy. Like I said earlier, that the way he greeted you when you first, that he opened it up and you said, Helene, his wife, was probably a large reason why. It was, you were there for a while. And as far as you knew, that photograph on the wall was it.
Right.
And you wondered, where in the world is all the flotsam and jetsam of this 34-year career? And you're kind of getting ready to leave. And Helene said,
you can show him now. And so that was a point. I had no idea what she was talking about. He stood up. He had some keys on his belt loop, and he walked me through the kitchen to the basement. And the basement was locked. I didn't know why anyone would need their basement locked. We walked downstairs, basement. He turned on a light, and it was like being slipped behind some sort of magical curtain. There were all kind of framed photographs of Mr. Allen in the presidents that he worked for. There were photographs of him and the celebrities who had visited the White House over the years. Ella Fitzgerald, Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Martin Luther King Jr., Martin Luther King Sr., Michael Jackson, the pop star, Don King. And I'm spinning now. I'm just spinning. There were gifts from the president. There was a painting from Eisenhower. There was a Stetson hat from LBJ. There was a tie from JFK that his wife had given to the butler the day after the assassination. It was amazing. I mean, it was like being dropped into the Smithsonian. But all around one man's life. And I remember I took a step closer to him and I said, Mr. Allen, now, are you sure that no one has ever written a long narrative about your life? Because I knew in the back of my mind, I sure as heck was getting ready to do it. I mean,
you just want to make sure.
Oh, yeah, I knew that for sure. I mean, I was ready to run out of there. And he took a step closer to me and he said, if you think I'm worthy, you'll be the first. Wow. And I had to step away from him then and walk over to a wall because my eyes were starting to well up and I did not want him to see me tears falling from my eyes because it was very painful to hear him wonder aloud if he was worthy of a story.
Well, Will Haygood, thank you so much for writing that story, for inspiring the film that is coming soon.
Friday. Movie opens in... one day, tomorrow.
All right.
The movie opens
tomorrow.
Nationwide,
so,
everywhere.
Nationwide and around the world. Will Haygood, Washington Post reporter, author of The Butler, A Witness to History. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a delight, as usual.
It was wonderful, as it always is with you. And thank you very much.
Once again, we'll have more information about that September 17th event at Ohio Dominican University with Will Haygood and others. Just check out our website at wosu.org. It's free. September 12th, I'm sorry, at 7 p.m. It's free. Once again, to the All Sides staff, couldn't do it without you. You got me through another week. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Chaban, Leticia Wiggins, Annalise Dahl, Andrew Zissler, Emmanuel Joshi, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News. Use your all-day NPR news station.